Welcome to Sharp Insights, conversations with your plan giving experts, a podcast for development professionals. Whether you're new to the field or looking to enhance your existing program, we will provide practical tips, expert advice, and real-world stories to deepen your understanding of plan giving. If you're committed to securing long-term support for your nonprofit, you've come to the right place.
Welcome to Sharp Insights, conversations with your plan giving experts. I'm your host, Grant Miller. The plan giving world is personal, and donors, being human, can take things personally, for better or worse. In today's episode, we're addressing a sensitive topic that every fundraiser faces, but few openly discuss: repairing strained relationships. Today, we'll explore the early warning signs of eroding trust, common mistakes that unintentionally harm donor confidence, and practical steps you and your organization can take to reestablish connections and rebuild credibility. We're joined today by Brett Bicoy, President and CEO of the Door County Community Foundation. With decades of leadership in community philanthropy and national recognition for his efforts to promote charitable giving, Brett offers valuable insights into how strong donor relationships can create lasting impact for your organization's mission. Brett, thanks for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here.
Based on your experience, what are the early warning signs that a donor relationship has potentially changed or might be at risk?
Well, it's all about patterns, right? We all sort of fall into ways we interact with each other. And it's different for each person. The call that might come in quarterly, the check that comes in once a month, the emails that go back and forth. What you're looking for is anything that changes in the pattern with that donor. So if they start interacting with you differently, you know then something's going on. Now, you have to be careful, because maybe the thing that's going on is their wife is sick, or their dog is not doing well, or they have some other financial issue in their life that's causing a strain that has nothing to do with the relationship with you. But what you do know is when those patterns change, that's when you have to look for a reason to reach out, just the touch base, check in with them, and see if there's actually something there that you should be attentive to.
Okay, so if any red flags come up in communications or anything like that, just follow up and...
Well, I don't even know that I would call them a red flag so much as just a change in behavior.
Okay.
Right. There are times when my wife will come home and doesn't do what she's normally doing, and she's irritated and angry, and it may not be at me. Right. Mm-hmm. It might be something that she did when she's a teacher. So it might have been one of her students or something that was going on with a parent. But at other times, it really is me. Right. So when that change of behavior is going on, you know that something's occurring. What you've got to figure out is whether that relationship you have with the donor is changing somehow, or whether there's something else going on in the donor's life. The nice thing about it, though, is if it's not about you, you're actually helping to strengthen that relationship, because they understand that you're checking in with them because something has changed, and they appreciate the fact that you're so attentive to them.
Okay. Well, when something like this happens, when it is about the organization and a donor feels overlooked or misunderstood, or there was a miscommunication about something, or the organization just made a mistake somewhere, what's the first step that organizations should take when trying to rebuild trust?
Own it. Own the error, own the mistake, and go headlong into it. You know, we have a tendency when a mistake has occurred, whether it's ours or just a perceived mistake, but we didn't actually make it, but something has gone wrong, we very often get uncomfortable with it and are unwilling to confront the issue and go headlong into the situation. The first thing you ought to be doing is reaching out to the donor if you made the mistake and fessing up to it, admitting, hey, we screwed this up. Here's what happened. Here's why it happened. One of the things I will do in those situations is, mistakes are always one of two things. Right? It's either a failure of the process or a failure of the people to execute the process, right? The failure of the process is a gift of this kind came in and it doesn't really fit the process. So the normal steps we take aren't functional. So we've got to go and fix the process to accommodate that unusual transaction. Or maybe the failing was that the process would work fine, but we as humans failed to execute it. You want the donor to know that you are not just apologizing for the error and owning it, but you're learning from it, right? One of the great things you want to show the donor is that, hey, we're an organization that believes in the idea of continuous improvement. We've bought into the idea of excellence is a journey, not a destination. And we're going to show you that by trying to talk to you about the error. We're going to own the error. We're going to admit the error. And then we're going to show you what we're doing to make it better. So very often I'll make that first call and I'll say, I apologized. Here's what happened. And really, I'm the CEO. So it's possible, maybe even likely, the error was not mine, right? It was an error that went somewhere else in the office that somebody handled. But it's important that I be the guy making that call, because it shows them that A, the person in charge takes it seriously, and B, we're going to fix it. And then I circle back around a week or two later or whatever it is, when we figured out what went wrong, why it went wrong, and how we're going to make sure it never happened again. And what you'll find is if you do this, you can actually strengthen the relationship with the donor. If you handle it with integrity, with honesty and openness, they enjoy that and they appreciate it. Now, if you keep making the mistakes, then you know, you're kind of out of luck. If it's a one-off, so I always tell the team, let's not be afraid we make a mistake. We don't want to make them. But when we do, let's use it as a way to further the relationship by showing them that we are human, we admit it, and we're willing to learn from it.
Yeah, taking ownership seems like a great way to repair that. I wanted to zoom in just a little bit. You know, you mentioned process and execution, but what are some more detailed, maybe common mistakes that organizations might make that unintentionally damage donor trust that they may not be aware of?
It's the little things. We know if you're successful in your organization in generating sizable gifts, you're not so foolish as to let an interpersonal relationship go bad, right? You're probably not so foolish as to not be attentive to them. Those aren't the common mistakes. Those are the uncommon mistakes, right? The common mistakes are the little things. Right? Spelling a donor's name wrong on a thank you letter. Sending them a thank you letter that was really for John Smith and we sent it to Jim Smith in mistake, right? Those little kinds of things erode trust. The way I think of it is like a house, right? We're all really aware of when there's a tree next door and there's a hurricane coming through that we got to attend to that tree to make sure it doesn't fall in. But that's not normally what's going to cause the house to collapse. It's going to be the little drip in the attic of one drip of a mistake and another and another, and it undermines the foundation of the roof and then the whole thing collapses. And so if you're asking what the most common mistakes are, it's the little things that we forget to pay attention to that show them that we're attentive to them. And think about how that plays out. If the donor who's alive and well is watching us and we can't get things right, the little details, how can they possibly trust it to get it right when they're gone? How can we ask them to trust us to hold their assets when they're gone and use it in a productive way if when they're watching us, we still can't get it right? So a lot of that trust is not just trust in the people, it's a trust in the processes and the institutions. And that's where those little itty bitty things, you know, you send the invitation to the wrong place, you put them on the wrong table at an event. Those things are the little drip in the roof that if left unattended will cause its eventual collapse.
What about, and I think a lot of organizations face this time and time again, what about turnover in plan giving departments? And, you know, how can fundraisers respond when leadership changes might disrupt longstanding relationships? Like maybe a donor has a certain type of relationship with a certain person and then they're gone. How do you navigate that situation?
Well, like a lot of problems, the best solution to them is to avoid the problem in the first place. One of the most common things I see with young fundraising professionals is they forget that their job is not simply to build a relationship with the donor. It's to take that relationship and transfer it to the organization, right? To help them have faith in more than just the person that the donor happened to be talking to. And so it's not an uncommon thing that if you're not managing your team well and working with them well to help them understand that, they're spending a lot of time making, hey, we love John on the team. He's terrific. And then John leaves and then the donor's left there having no relationship with anything or anyone at the organization. A lot of this is about making sure that we build relationships with other people in the organization on different levels and having them have interactions long before that occurs. And so how do you solve that problem? Well, frankly, very often it means you're starting maybe not at ground zero, but if you were at 100 miles an hour with the donor, you've slowed to 25, right? Whereas if we've done our job well and the person the donor has been working with is gone, well, we're still going to slow down somewhat, but we're only slowing down to 90 miles an hour and 80 miles an hour with the donor. And we can pick that back up with the people around them. It's incumbent upon us in this field to recognize that it's not about any one of us. It's about the institution. And that's not just the fun. fundraisers, by the way. That's also the chief executives of these organizations. I lead a small foundation. I don't care if you lead a big university, right? The idea is you need to make sure as a leader of the organization that the people that are your best friends understand and recognize that there's a team of people doing this work, right? At the Door County Community Foundation, most donors have some interaction with me, especially on the front end of this thing. But very quickly, there are other people on the staff that I want them to get to know, not because I want to avoid them, but because it's my job to make sure they have relationships with the team and the organization, not just with me. And if you do that well, you find yourself in a situation that when transition occurs, and sadly, the graying of my hair is evidence that one day my transition will occur. But if I do it properly, then there'll be people here that will have a relationship with our donors so that when I'm gone, they'll continue to be enthusiastic supporters.
Great advice. Thank you. What about when maybe a donor does fall through the cracks a little bit because of turnover or some other reason? What are some ways or some strategies to reconnect with a donor who's become inactive after maybe even years of involvement with an organization?
Sure. One of my favorite things to do is to find someone or something new at the organization and use that as the re-entry point for somebody who's lapsed. The easiest is when the chief executive changes over. And if not, maybe there's a department head, maybe there's a position somewhere along the line. And whenever I encounter someone new, for example, who is going into a role as an executive director or chief executive of a charity in my community, the first thing I tell them to do is said, look, obviously start by visiting your best friends and making sure that they're well taken care of. But then go to your team and say, give me the list of any donor who gave X amount or more, whatever your threshold is for your organization, that's a sizable gift, and haven't given for the last year or 2 years or 3 years. Then you go out and give them a phone call, right? And stand there and say, hey, this is Brett. I'm the new CEO of the XYZ organization. And I wanted to see if we can find some time for you and I to sit down. I'm not going to come to ask for a gift, but I'm calling you because I need to learn what we did wrong that caused you to believe that we no longer were worthy of your support. I'm here to learn from you. Now, that's a hard call to make because it's uncomfortable and you're going to hear some awkward things potentially, right? But it's an opportunity to reopen. Now, the donor, if they've been giving you large gifts, clearly has a fondness in their heart for you to some degree, but it's waned because of whatever occurred. But opening that door and going out and visiting with them and learning from them. And then you have to be genuine about it, right? I mean, you can't be, people are smart. They can tell if you're just there listening because you're trying, getting ready to ask for the next gift. You need to go into that space with the idea that clearly we did something wrong. Even if it was the donor's perception was wrong, that's our fault. We allowed that perception to fester because unless your organization, unless my organization now is somehow not worthy of support anymore because we stopped doing our jobs well or aren't effective as an organization, if we're still doing our job well, then why did that donor not see that, that once believed in it? And you need to have that conversation. You explore it with them. You don't take the gift, right? Even if they want to give you a gift in that meeting, you're just like, no, I promised you I wasn't going to. What I wanted to do was to listen. And in fact, I'm going to go and talk to several other people because frankly, if it's a major donor of yours who is angry, they have friends and it's entirely likely that some of their friends are unhappy with you as well. You're going to go and visit with all of them. You're going to listen to what they say. And then you're going to circle back around to them and say, here's what we learned. Here's what we heard. Here are things that we're going to try to do better. And again, I'm not asking for your support. I just want you to know that we learned from what you taught us. And you'd be amazed at how often it re-engages the donor. It gets them excited because they're giving you something, right? The object is to get the donor to give you something. In this case, they're giving you time. They're giving you advice. They're giving you their wisdom. They're giving you their honesty, right? So they've given you a bunch of things already. If you use those gifts well, it's not hard for them to see a financial gift to follow that. But it requires patience and it requires going into uncomfortable rooms and hearing things you might not want to hear, but using it as a learning opportunity to help A, make your organization better, but then B, hopefully turn the donor around in the long run.
So when something like this happens, we should name it, acknowledge it, own it, and then approach the donor by listening and asking questions as opposed to, say, pleading our case.
Yeah, pleading is the worst thing to do in the world in this situation, right? You don't want to try to convince them they were wrong. That's not why you're there, right? Mm-hmm. Think of it this way. Your job in that meeting, you're not trying to get a financial gift. And goodness knows you're not trying to convince them of anything. What you're asking for that is, I'd like the gift of your wisdom. I'd like the gift of your time to help me understand how we can be better, because I'm a new leader of this department. I'm a new leader of the organization. I'm a new whatever I am. But the newness of you in that role allows you to open a door that might otherwise be closed. And that's why whenever there's a major department head change or even a CEO change, it ought to be a high priority, because the CEO of a substantial organization, everybody's going to want to meet him, right? And so obviously the big donors are going to get to see him, but for the lapsed donors to see them as well, that says a lot to the lapsed donors. It's one of those rare opportunities you have to really listen and learn. But as you said, it's about owning it, being honest, being transparent, and you have to enter the space honestly. You're not a salesman. I mean, that's the whole reason why we work in philanthropy. I am an awful salesman, because I have to love, believe, and live what I do. And I can talk about it all day and I believe in what I do, but I can't sell a used car because I can't do it. I don't feel it in my bones. So if you approach these conversations that way, you'd be amazed at how often donors are receptive to it. Because again, remember, they loved you once. Something changed. And this is the rapprochement, right? This is your opportunity to repair the relationship, not by talking, but by listening and learning, by the way, and learning.
Great. You know, we talk a lot about process and execution. And if I came to you and had some issues with some donors and realized that it was a process issue and not sort of a one-off issue or anything like that, what advice would you give about building systems that prevent these mishaps from happening and these breakdowns in relationships with donors and just keep those things from happening in the first place?
Oh, that could be a whole nother podcast. I tell you, I am a process fanatic in the sense that once every 3 years at the Community Foundation, which I work, we take what are whole days. So it might take 4 or 5 days. We do it over the winter because I'm a northern community. And so a lot of people go south for the winter. So it's a little quieter this time of year. And we will cover the walls of conference rooms with chart paper and post-it notes as we map out every key process. And the idea is we're constantly looking at, do the processes still make sense, right? Because the world changed, technology changes, staff changes, the size of the organization changes. And we're looking for, how does a check flow, for example, if we're just using that example, how do we take a check that it receives in the mail that comes into the office, everything from logging that information into the system, putting notes in for the development professionals to understand the relationship and what's going on there, to the thank you letters, to the outreach, what's that whole series of steps that have to go on when that gift occurs? And one of the things that I'm a big believer on is what I call it a feedback loop. And that's probably the wrong thing to say to a podcaster. But I mean, a feedback loop in the sense that anything that's important that leaves the Door County Community Foundation has had two human eyes on it, right? There's a thank you letter and I'm signing that thing and I'm looking at it. When it goes over to our administrative assistant, her job is not just to take it and shove it in the envelope. She's supposed to look at it and go, okay, is the name right? Is it spelled correctly? Does the check, because she's got it on a digital form on a screen, does the check amount match what's on the gift, right? And it's a small thing. If we don't get transactions right, if we don't get their name spelled right, if we don't do the little things, the donor is never going to trust in our processes. Because ultimately, an estate gift is really, there are two foundational things that lead to an estate gift, right? It's trust in the people. Right? Do I trust that the people who lead this organization and make this organization go, are they good people? Are they people of integrity? Are they people who share the values that I'm trying to promote with my charitable gift? And the other foundational piece of it is the organization itself in terms of its processes. Do we use the money efficiently? Do we use it wisely? Do we put it where we need to go? Are we accountable for it? Right? If you can't get those two things right, the donor is going to look at you and say, yeah, I'm going to give you money while I'm here to look over your shoulder. But how can I trust that when I'm gone, you're going to get this right? Because I've had to call you 3 times in the last 2 years to say, hey, you spelled my name wrong, or you put the money to this event and I wanted it to go to the other event, or for this project as opposed to the other one. You got to get that stuff right.
Is the process for engaging with a donor where you might have made a mistake or something, does it differ when working with someone who might have just made a single gift at an annual event or even in a major gift?
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe like a one-off gift. What is the difference there and how does that work?
When I'm giving an annual gift, it's often out of responsibility. It's out of obligation. It's very much an intellectual investment. Oh, yeah, I understand the value of what they do. I need to support that work. And it's because it's a gift that typically comes out of income, right? It's a smaller gift. Major gifts, campaign gifts, well, those are typically out of assets. So already it's a larger investment for them. Major giving is more visceral, right? Because it's really about, I need to feel good about the gift. It's not the intellectual thing I'm doing because I understand the value of the organization. It's the gift is also making me feel good about that project. The legacy gift is very often, in fact, usually, the largest gift the person will ever make because they're giving the money away when they no longer need it. So it requires a level of trust that is not required for the gift, even the major gift or the annual gift. You know, if I'm giving you the major gift and I wanted you to paint the building brown because I'm giving you $500,000 for it and you paint it blue, I can call you out on it, right? But if I'm giving it to you when I'm gone, and it's the biggest gift I've ever made, it's going to be a challenge if they don't trust you to do those kinds of things. You know, one of the things that we talk about, which I don't agree with, quite frankly, is they talk about how a legacy gift is including a person as a part of their family. And I get the thinking because I can give the money to my family or friends, and I'm adding the charity that I love. And love is a real thing here as a part of that conversation. But it's not really family, it's more than that. Because, you know, even if I'm estranged from my kid, it's going to be that I'm going to want to remember in my estate plan, right? I feel also an obligation. I feel a responsibility. To the charity, it's ultimately the charity is a vehicle to accomplish a good, right? We are tools to do something good for the world. And fundamentally, what the donor is buying is not a gift to the institution, right? They're giving a gift because that institution is going to somehow epitomize a value that the donor thinks is important. And it's going to affect that, which is, by the way, another difference, right? The major gift is not a value-driven gift so much as I want to accomplish a goal. This is really about a values. I want to impart my values on the larger community. So it's a higher level of responsibility. Yes, it's kind of like family because they love us, but it's more than they love us. They have to respect us, right? They have to feel like we are capable, confident people that engender confidence in them, that we're going to be able to have the kind of impact in the world that they want to. So love is an important part of that, like it is for any family, but there's a layer on top of that. I can just love my kids, and even if they're not responsible, I'm probably going to do something for them, right? But if there's a charity in my plan and I don't think they're responsible with my money, they're not going to affect the values that I want on the world, I'm not going to include them. And so to me, it's they're part of the family, but not because they just are related to me. They're part of the family because of what they do. And so that's why getting the guy's name wrong on a thank you letter is so darn important. And those are the most common mistakes you make are the little ones, because we think, oh, I've done the great job shaking his hand and taking him out to dinner, not recognizing that we're irritating them every time we get these little things wrong. And we're undermining our ability to say, wow, this is an organization that I can trust when I'm gone to do things right and to live my legacy, to live my values in the world, even though I'm not here.
Yeah, that's interesting. We often talk about the idea of elevating organizations to family. I appreciate the concept of taking it a little bit further.
And again, there's a lot of truth to that, but we're not family, right? We're not. There's a commitment to family that transcends the little quirkiness and the goofiness, and in a way that, as an organization, if we fail to do those things properly, that love is not going to sustain the gift, right? If they don't feel like we are going to be an effective steward of their money, they're not going to leave the contribution. And so it's so important that we have integrity, owning mistakes, getting your processes right, making sure that they know where we're coming from, making sure they know that it's not just the guy in my chair who outlives him, but someone here has to outlive me, right? It's about making sure as an organization, we're all sort of moving in the same direction. The beautiful thing about it is it's actually, I think, more rewarding because I've seen many an estate where there's the ne'er-do-well child that's included in there because they need to be included in there. But the reason that the organization, the charity is included in there is because it's not ne'er-do-well. It's just the opposite. It's because they're impactful. They're ones that are doing great things, and I believe it, and I see it as a donor, and that's why I want to give to them. And that's the kind of worthiness we want, because we're not a child. We can't be the ne'er-do-well child, and we're going to encounter the gift. We have to be worthy of the gift, and we can never forget that. And I think sometimes when we talk about it as a family member, we spend so much time on the relationship aspect of it, which is important, but we forget that fundamentally, it's not the relationship that is what will drive the gift. It's an important, very important part of it. I don't want to minimize that at all. But I'm saying that I can be the most charming guy in the world and the best buddy of a donor, but if we don't do good things with their money, they're not going to give us a penny in their estate plan.
Yeah, so it comes down to making sure you do the right things with the donations that they make. But, you know, I do think it is really important to remember that little things can have big consequences. Like if somebody sends me something and my name's spelled wrong, that's what I'm going to focus and pay attention to, you know. It doesn't really matter what the content of the letter is. You know, that might have some influence, but people take that sort of thing really seriously.
How fast does your thank you letter get out, right? I mean, we have a standard here, one business day. That's why we're going to get this money out, because we believe so strongly that the donor has to know that we value them and that we're going to pay attention to them. I wrote year-end giving with Christmas, and I wrote a bunch of checks to some prominent organizations, and it's mid-February and I got a thank you letter, by the way. And it said, "Dear donor," spelled D-O-N-E-R, right?
Oh, no.
As opposed to my name, 6 weeks, 8 weeks after I made the gift, right? Now, I believe in the mission of the organization. I'm going to continue to support it because that's an important organization. But do you think that I would ever include that in my estate plan? Do you think that I'm going to increase my current giving or do an annual, go to a major gift right away without having something done better? And the irony is, they're good people and they understand the importance of relationships, but they haven't paid enough attention to the processes. And I think sometimes we as development professionals, we forget that we can be the most charming people in the world, but if the folks in the office who aren't actually doing the work, getting things done, being effective and impactful with the dollars, if that's not done right, then nothing else matters.
That's a great reminder. And when our producer Ashley hears this, I can just already feel her anger at the misspelling of the word donor that I go out there into the world.
Well, my name is Brett with one T, right? And I tell of times it's spelled with two, right? My son is Brett Jr., so he likes to tell people it's Brett, not Brettita, right? So,
Brettita.
But it's one of those things that if you can't get that right, I mean, really? Again, it's a small thing, but that's what I mean by the drip. A single drip in the roof does nothing. It doesn't, right? If we make one, but if we've got an organization where culturally we're not valuing the importance of excellence in everything we do, not just in relationships, but excellence in all kinds of interactions, all the things that we do, it's not one drip. It's another and another. And over time, those little annoyances with the donor undermines the foundation of the whole roof, and the thing will eventually collapse. And there goes your gift. There's a great statistic where something like 55% of all estate gifts are finalized within 5 years before your passing. Now that I think about it, I learned that number at the last seminar I went to by Sharp. So there's a good plug for the value of Sharp seminars, right? But one of the powerful things about it to me is you can set up that estate gift today with the 70-year-old, but their life expectancy is 15 more years, right? So they're going to have 15 more years of interactions with us. So we darn well better be constantly not just tending to the relationship in terms of how we talk to the person, but in the way we steward their money, the way we show them respect by getting things right and handling things properly, because they can change their mind at the last minute. One of the things that's changed in my 30 years in this career is estate gifts really are some of the biggest things that I'm dealing with right now are people in their 80s. 25 years ago, this stuff was all settled by then. The conversations I was having in the estate gift was really by 75, you thought it was too late because the estate was already done and they're never going to make a change. Now it's well into the 80s where people are making decisions and changes. So we have to be stewarding that thing in all ways, shapes, and forms all the way up until they sadly leave this world.
Thank you for that. Let's wrap this up on a positive note. And I'm wondering if you can share a story from your career where a relationship that was drained in some way was restored, and what made the difference there?
So I came in, this is 30 years ago, and it shows you how old I'm getting. I was a young kid. And
you started when you were five, right?
That's exactly right. Yes. Yes. I would totally agree with that, except my oldest daughter, I think, just turned 35. So yesterday, I remember taking over the role of director of a really small entity, you know, just a handful of people. And there was a little bit of a disagreement about the transition, and the money had been shifted around, and there were some angry people about it. Now, I didn't know any of this, right? I'm just a guy applying for a job, excited to be doing some things, working with families and supporting folks in the community and that sort of thing. And I remember going to a breakfast, and this was like day three on the job. And I'm on a breakfast, and one of the big supporters of the organization previously stood up and it shared his objections with everything that had gone on with me right there in the room. So, because I'm too dumb for my own good, the first thing I did when the meeting adjourned is I went over to him and I said, "We need to go have a cup of coffee." He said, "I'm going to come by into your office." And he goes, "Oh, I don't want to." I'm like, no, let me come over to your office. I said, "Well, let's find a time." I said, "I'm not, again, I just want to sit down and learn about what it is that's frustrating to you, because we've got to figure out how to make this better, because the mission of the organization is too important." I went over to his office. We probably spent an hour and a half together. He walked me to the parking lot and became a good friend, frankly, and an enormous supporter over the years of that organization. And it just, again, it sort of legitimizes the idea that if we made a mistake, even though it wasn't my mistake, because I just started, I was on day three on the job, the organization made a mistake in his mind. Well, we got to own it. We've got to confront it and talk with people. And here's the thing about it. Even if I had not built a relationship with that guy, right? And even if you've chosen never to give us another penny, minimally what I've done is I've turned somebody who's actively hostile towards us to being somebody who's just benign, right? He may not be a friend, but at least he's not going out there moaning and complaining about all the work we do to his friends, right? He's just like, I met the new guy. Yeah, it's all right, right? I'm not giving them any more money, but the guy's no longer complaining about it. And that's sometimes the best you can do. But nothing bad ever comes from reaching out and trying to engage somebody who's unhappy. If it doesn't work, you've made the effort, you've showed that effort. And usually most of them will begrudgingly respect your attempt to try.
Okay.
Believe me, when you've made as many mistakes over the years as I have, I am fantastic at apologizing for the stupidity of things that I've done.
I always tell my son that the L in lose stands for lesson. Well, based on our conversation today, is there any closing thoughts you want to leave us with? Or is there anything that we didn't talk about that we ought to?
I don't know. We talked about an awful lot. But I guess what I would say, if I was going to summarize all sort of what we've been talking about today, is relationships obviously are key to all of these things. But it's more than just interpersonal. It's a relationship with the organization. Right. It's a relationship with the materials we send them. It's a relationship with our mail. It's a relationship with our website. It's a relationship with our organizational processes. It's all of that stuff together. And the greatest fundraisers in the world are ultimately not going to secure the estate gift, which is the hardest gift to get because it's the largest gift people make, unless it's the whole package of the organization. So if you're leading a charity, you need to understand the importance of not just great fundraisers, but great processes, great staff, great program staff, the whole nine yards. And if you're not leading the organization and you're on the fundraising side, you have to make sure that you are well-versed on that other side of the business and certainly making arguments that investments be made, not just in hiring the next communications person or development person, but also to make sure the finance office is really well-staffed and working well. Because if they don't do their job well, the development team isn't going to be able to do theirs.
Thank you. So name it, acknowledge it, own it, listen and learn. Fix your processes if they're broken, and even the most strained relationships can come out stronger. Brett, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your expertise, and we look forward to having you back for that next episode.
I was glad to be here.
If you found today's episode helpful, please subscribe and share with your colleagues in the field. Thank you for being a part of the conversation. Until next time, I'm Grant Miller.
Thanks for listening. We hope today's discussion gave you practical takeaways to grow your plan giving program. To submit questions and topics for future episodes, go to sharpgroup.org or listen to us on your favorite podcast app. If you found this podcast insightful, be sure to like, review, and subscribe. Until then, stay sharp.